If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This facility is a mess, totally not up to Imperial standards.
He says that it's due to his haste. He could perform tidier necropsies of the alien species requested, but it would require more time.
Lord Vader has absolutely forbidden a third episode. The analysis needs to be completed today.
The surgical droid is requesting that we each hold a flap of tissue.
I am just here to supervise. Doesn't he have extra arms for precisely this reason?
Those are for waving around.
All right, then.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our Star Wars alien necropsies. So in the last episode, if you haven't heard that yet, you should probably just go listen to that one first, where we discuss what we're doing here, and then come back and rejoin us for this one. But hey, if you're all caught up, here we are again. And last time we talked about some aliens from the Star Wars galaxy. We talked about some vacuum dwellers like the Exogorth and the Minox, and compared that to some real world biology, both definite and hypothetical. And we also talked about the Jedi Togruta, a powerful and honorable species of alien with awesome stuff on their heads. But we're back again, and I think it's heads up first again today, isn't it?
It is, and I'm glad you mentioned the Togruta, because basically it comes down to the situation where you have various scenes in Star Wars, cantina scenes, Jedi Council scenes, etc., where part of the fun is like, wow, look at the alien diversity, and look at all the strange things going on with morphology, with these aliens' heads and bodies. But of course, if we're looking at things from a biological standpoint, things are shaped certain ways for a reason. Things have evolved into different forms for a reason. And those strange heads you see just filling up the space, if we were to look at them with scientific scrutiny, and also lean into the imagination, into the fantasy a bit, you know, all these things have a purpose. And we can turn, of course, to canon and to the fiction itself to get some of those answers. But then a lot of the fun is in extrapolating and saying, well, what else could it be used for? Or if the thing they're telling me is true, what are the ramifications, often the unexplored ramifications of that?
Right. What can you deduce about the ancestral environment of the creature that confronts Luke in the Mos Eisley Cantina with the weird little lobes on his chin?
I actually know the answer to that one. I think that was that one has been described in canon. I think it's canon anyway, as being like a surgical, it's like a self-surgical addict. So that, so all those weird features are at least partially the result of self-surgery.
Wow.
I think that's right. Could be wrong on that. We might have to take that out if I'm wrong. But I believe that's the case.
That is not the answer I expect. Wait, are you talking about the guy who talks to Luke or just
yes.
the guy who grunts? No, I meant the guy who grunts at him, who has the weird little kind of like the butt on his mouth or chin area.
Yes. I don't know as much about those guys, but okay. they are described at length in some of the books that that I've looked at. One of which I want to go ahead and mention is Star Wars Alien Archive, which is just a wonderful illustrated tome of aliens from all the Star Wars movies up through Solo. And it had just wonderful illustrations, nice little write-ups about them. It's one of these books that that I got for my son sometime last year, early last year, and we've already worn it out. There are pages falling out of it. Anytime you get the book out, you have to reinsert different parts of it that have come apart. It's mm-hmm. It's seen a lot of wear and tear and love. So I highly recommend that one.
Yeah, I think we've talked many times before about our love for the illustrated encyclopedias of fictional worlds, and this is a great one.
But the first selection I want to make here today is not a creature from a cantina. It is, in fact, a creature from that we first encounter in the Jedi Council scenes in Star Wars: The Phantom Menace. Now, I don't know if you remember these guys or not, or really, there's mainly one guy that we encounter. Mm-hmm. But the species, they're known as the Sarians.
Oh, this is the guy who looks like a wizard, but with a tower head. So it's almost
yes.
as if the Tower of Isengard has been incorporated into Saruman's skull.
Yes, these were a bipedal, largely humanoid species. We're told they're native to the planet Saria, and they're most notable for their enlarged, vaguely conical craniums, though they lack the pronounced cone heads of the Remulakians of cone heads fame. We're told that they have two hearts, the second of which is said to supply extra blood and oxygen to their most curious neurobiology, and that is a binary brain.
Ah, okay. I can see why this caught your attention.
Yes. So what is meant by a binary brain? Well, in, again, the excellent illustrated Star Wars Alien Archive, it is said that the Sarian binary brain is, quote, able to process many things at the same time, sort through data quickly, and also consider two sides of the same argument simultaneously.
Parallel processing.
Yeah, and it's also been suggested, I think, in perhaps this is like an extended universe, novelization thing, but it's been suggested that this sort of brain structure allows at least certain members of the Sarian species, especially like Force-sensitive individuals, to explore both the light and the dark side of the Force in ways that are maybe somewhat safer compared to just normal dabbling in the dark side.
Oh, I see. So the understanding is that normally if you are to explore the dark side, it's kind of not possible to just do that as a curiosity. Like, learning the dark side necessarily will corrupt and contaminate your brain. And so if you have a divided mind like this, maybe you can sort of quarantine the half of your brain that does get corrupted with that so that it doesn't spread to the other half. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I believe the argument is. I haven't actually read anything or viewed anything where they get into that. But certainly if anyone out there has, if you're familiar with whatever novelization or novel or comic this happens to be from, I'd love to hear a little bit more. Now, the most famous and recognizable Sarian is without a doubt Jedi Master Kai Adi-Mundi, hero general of the Clone Wars who fought alongside the likes of Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi. He fought at the first and second battles of Geonosis and perished during the invasion of Megiddo with the 21st Nova Corps when Supreme Chancellor Palpatine initiated Order 66. He was skilled with a lightsaber. He was a skilled force combatant, but he was equally known and respected for his logic and tactics, that big brain of his.
Yeah, that would make sense. I seem to recall his death scene. I think it's in Revenge of the Sith. He's like running across a bridge or something?
Yeah, I think it's a bridge battle.
And all the clone troopers start shooting him in the back.
Yeah. Yeah. So he
tragic.
He definitely goes down. But you don't see a lot of him in the live action stuff, but and in those prequel films he was played by an actor by the name of Silas Carson under heavy effects makeup. But in the Clone Wars animated series, the main one, he was voiced by British-Israeli actor Brian George, who does a great job with him, and they have a little more time to flesh him out. And in the 2003 Clone Wars series from Gendy Tartakovsky, you don't have... you don't really have a lot of character development there, but you have a lot of action. That's a very action-centric series. Mm-hmm. And in that, Master Mundi is an absolute shirt-ripping beast. Like, he's running around with, like, his head bandaged and his shirt torn open with all these muscles, and he's just, like, you know, killing the thousands of droids. It's pretty fun.
Oh, wow. So he's, like, your Hunter from the Future mode.
Yeah.
Just slaying.
But, you know, okay, it's impressive that he can do stuff with the lightsaber and then he can go into beast mode, but... A main thing we're going to talk about here is this idea of a binary brain. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, there's no definitive word on the exact structure of the Sarian brain or brains, but I think there are essentially a couple of ways to look at what might be going on inside that skull of theirs.
Okay, let's hear it. What's the first option?
Okay, first option would be just, of course, a supersized brain that enables this binary mental process. Composed of two lobes like ours, or maybe more lobes, I don't know. You know, when you're getting into an unknown alien brain, who's to say, right?
Sure.
And Sarian brain evolution could certainly follow the ice cream scoop model of human brain evolution. I think we've discussed this on the show before, but as explained by Kyle Moon-Kittrick in a 2010 Discover Magazine article, quote, evolution built our brain by taking simpler brains and just piling more brains on top, like adding scoops of ice cream to an ice cream cone.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. I mean, obviously, we always want to be careful not to oversimplify the way we think about the structures of the brain, because brains are complex and all that. But in rough terms, I think that is sort of true. Like at the lower levels of the brain, you have the more sort of automatic processes of the body and the more base level things like emotional type reactions. And then when you get further and further into the younger parts of the brain, younger in an evolutionary sense, toward the top and front of the brain, you get these, you know, these cortexes, which are very involved in executive function and a lot of the things we think of as higher level thinking and behavior.
Yeah. So Moon-Kittrick describes, like, the first layer is actually the cone, and that's the nervous jellyfish cone. And then you get your instinctive lizard scoop piled on top of that, then the memory mouse scoop, then the thinking ape scoop on top of that. So each layer brings with it great pros that enable the human brain to function and evolve, but also arguably certain cons, and that's one of the things they get into in this article. But for our purposes, yeah, I think you could look at the Sarian brain as essentially a human-level brain with additional scoops towering atop the rest of the cone, enabling this vastly increased functionality.
Now, you might think, well, what would the cons of having higher brain function be? And I would just say, like, I'm not aware of any reptiles that really get bogged down in rumination.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I really hope, certainly a Jedi Master wouldn't have, well, Jedi Masters have to deal with the dark side too. I mean, that's kind of the thing, right? Like, higher cognition means you're open to the dark side.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall in the prequels that a lot of Jedi training is about purging emotions, or at least certain kinds of emotions, maybe not to the full Spock extent.
Yeah.
But at least, like, not letting impulsive emotional reactions guide your thinking, to be clear and to be, you know, to be able to use clear thinking in your mind when our natural tendency would be to get hot-headed.
Right. And then there's a lot of Buddhist Buddhism in there as well, dealing with, like, the idea of avoiding attachments and all.
Yeah.
Though we see that doesn't necessarily work out all that well for those who aspire to it,
right,
in those films. But even, like, in terms of, like, confronting the dark side, though, like, that's always been a part of the Star Wars world. I mean, back to Empire, when Luke goes into that swamp and he's completing his training, like, one of the things he does is he encounters that vision of Darth Vader that is also a vision of himself.
Right. I mean, I think we're supposed to take that as, like, Luke is being confronted by the possibility of what would happen if he himself were seduced by the dark side, which, of course, he does play pretty dangerous in the movies, right? He gets close.
Yeah, yeah. anyway, that's basically, this is like one idea, looking at this big brain, just one big brain in there.
Right. So it's like built up level by level, and maybe the additional brains are something like what you would put even on top of our neocortex, maybe. Like they've got like a neocortex or something.
Yeah. Now, another interpretation, and I think a more exotic one, and also maybe more fun, maybe more sci-fi fantasy, but also one that I think I've seen visually represented somewhere. I tried to hunt it down to see if I could, because I would have put it in our inside of our notes if I could, but I couldn't find it. But I think I've seen this represented visibly, and that is the idea that Saurians actually have two brains inside their skull, one positioned right on top of the other, just straight up two brains inside their heads.
So that would mean one of the brains is closer to the heart. Maybe that makes it easier to get blood flow to that one.
Well, that's why they have two hearts, Joe. Remember?
Oh, okay.
So the idea is that second heart is, I guess, powering the second brain or enabling just enough blood flow to get up there to work with both brains.
Okay.
I want to stress, I'm not talking two brains here in the sense that the human brain consists of two hemispheres connected by the corpus callosum, but two separate brains, perhaps each consisting of two hemispheres each. And I should also add that some descriptions refer to Saurian brains in a way that does seem to indicate two brains. And again, they do have two hearts, so I guess the duplicity seems to work out here. So of these two, I tend to lean more towards the actual two brains inside their heads. Mm-hmm. Though I guess you could do a third option that would be a variation on idea number two, and that would be that they just have a very large humanoid brain, but the hemispheres are not connected by something like the corpus callosum.
Oh, no, that's very interesting. I want to say some things, but I also don't want to preempt you because I know you're going to get into talking about split brain experiments here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. For sure.
But yeah, so the corpus callosum, at least we know in the human brain, enables a large amount of communication between the hemispheres. And in cases where the corpus callosum in humans has been severed, often a person can still live their life. Like you can function with your brain hemispheres severed and you can do things. But there are some very noticeable changes to how the brain or brains react to certain types of stimuli and scenarios under that condition.
Yeah, yeah. When the callosum has been severed, and then when you have, you have to have certain experimental scenarios in place to make it become obvious, because otherwise the individual doesn't notice and the people who know them probably don't notice.
Yeah.
But we'll get into all that in a second. Now, there are a lot of different directions you could go in here. Like, why? I mean, the big one is, like, why would they go in this direction? First of all, would it be natural? Would it be just an evolution? Or would it be something that was engineered? And in either case, like, why? Would it have to do with, why would they need this, like, higher cognitive state? Would it have something to do with, being an interstellar species or something to do with their home environment? I don't know. Mm.
Well, I mean, it makes me think about how there are species on Earth that have a more distributed model of intelligence and nervous system control. And a great example would be octopuses.
Yeah.
Like the octopus, of course, like they've got a central brain, but then they have ganglia throughout the body that are sometimes written about. And you could argue to what extent this is a fair characterization, but you could argue that octopuses in some ways also think with their arms in ways that are independent of the thinking that takes place in the centralized brain. So you can imagine there are scenarios where it's useful for an animal to have thinking or information processing happening at multiple different places within the body. But the Saurian seems kind of different because you can imagine with the octopus, okay, maybe somehow the arm needs to think independently of the central brain. But this is two central brains, brains in the head. So what's like the second one doing differently? How would that be distributed in a way that would be useful like the octopus's arm?
Yeah. And so... In thinking about possibilities, we also come into ideas of that, like philosophical or spiritual upgrades to the brain. I mean, why not? If we're trying to determine where we go from here, I mean, it seems like that's worth thinking about. I should also just go ahead and add that obviously big-headed aliens is just a long-standing trope, going back to the Outer Limits and so forth. So it's not like they invented the idea of big-headed aliens and big-headed future humanoids. It's been pretty much standard. But I don't know that I'm sure there's some sci-fi out there predating this in which a human had two brains, or a humanoid had two brains, aside from Steve Martin. But
the man with two brains, yeah.
But I'm not aware of it off the top of my head. But a lot of these considerations, like when we're talking about like what does this mean? What would two brains be like? I mean, it basically comes down to that. What would it be like to have two brains? What would conceivably be the mental state of an individual like Master Mundi here with two brains in their head?
Ah, so now you're getting into subjective experience, and this, of course, touches on really big questions that are still unsettled in human science and philosophy, stuff about, like, where consciousness resides and what it consists of.
Yeah. And ultimately, yeah, this is going to be unanswerable, and we just have to sort of speculate and have fun with the speculation. But on one level, you have to say that ultimately the mind of a alien being might just be impossible for us to comprehend. Mm-hmm. It just might be that different. On the other hand, you could say, well, having two brains in your head like this, it would just be like our mental experience. Because as we alluded to earlier, the human brain consists of two cerebral hemispheres connected by the corpus callosum, each with many different modules, all of these acting in concert with each other, interconnected. And we explored this at length in our episodes on split brain experiments. And of those experiments, most interestingly, one of the big take-homes was is that indeed, if you split the brain, you essentially split the person as well. We're talking one person per hemisphere of the brain, a division of self, not one that is obvious to the individual or to people around them, but again, presents itself when revealed through various experiments, particularly the Nobel-winning work of neuroscientists Roger Sperry and Michael Gazzaniga in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and so we go into much more depth in that pair of episodes from, I think it was a couple of years ago now, so you can go look those up if you want the full scoop. But they did find some very interesting things that I will say, we also talked in that episode, I think, about how there has been some research in recent years that sort of challenged their original findings, but people have pushed back against that research too. So it seems like, you know, this is one of the many things in psychology and neuroscience that's still an ongoing question. But at least what they appeared to find is that you can, for example, in a patient who's had their hemispheres severed through this radical severing of the corpus callosum, which is done not for the purpose of the experiment, but it's done specifically for people with really treatment-resistant epilepsy to prevent them from having these recurring terrible seizures. You can sever the corpus callosum. A person still reports being able to live their life generally, like it is not a debilitating thing to do to the brain, but it causes these strange things where, for example, it seems that some amount of information is prevented from being shared fully between the two different parts of the brain. And so, for example, it is widely that in most brains, it is the left hemisphere that seems to do the talking, like the language interactions with the outside world. And so you can present stimuli that are only within the sensory awareness of the right hemisphere of the brain, say by presenting it in a certain part of the visual field. And so the parts of the body controlled primarily by the right hemisphere of the brain can do things that seem to reflect knowledge of the stimulus that you have showed that hemisphere of the brain, but the person can't talk about that knowledge. They don't seem to have linguistic awareness of it, which is extremely weird.
Yeah, at times it kind of comes off as a sort of subtle duality of self. Some of the most interesting ideas that come out of it, Gazzaniga wraps up in his interpreter theory, which again we've discussed on the show, in which the left brain hemisphere contains some function that he calls the interpreter, which creates a sense of self, even if it is a completely false sense, by coming up with a post hoc explanation for behaviors.
Yeah, that there's this function that's largely seated within the left hemisphere that sort of tells the narrative story to your own brain that explains why you're doing what you're doing. It creates that moment-to-moment stream of consciousness that helps you understand your own behavior, even though it seems a lot of your own behavior is caused by things that are not actually within your awareness. It's not downstream from your consciousness, but upstream from your consciousness.
Now, I should also throw in that they did experiment with animals as well. And you know, there are limitations when you're looking at animal brains and, you know, trying to compare it to human brains. But they found that if they produced a split brain in some of these animals, first of all, of course, each side seemed to function independently of the other, but also that an animal with a split brain could memorize double the information. So that basic idea, again, we could, at least when talking about Star Wars, we could extrapolate to say, well, maybe if you did have two independent brains in your head, yeah, maybe you could process and contain double the information.
So that's really interesting, but I'm also really interested in this idea of exploring both sides of the Force with a brain like this that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, yeah. So with that in mind, let's consider a couple of take-homes. And again, we're kind of cherry-picking here, but a couple of take-homes from the split-brain research that Gazzaniga put forth. First of all, the interpreter function of the left brain makes it more likely to distort recall of events, and that the non-interpreting, non-explaining right brain has a more accurate recall function.
So it's not telling itself a story to post hoc rationalize whatever it's experiencing. It's logging information in a more objective sense.
Yeah, like one side is telling a story, crafting a story, mm-hmm. and retelling a story, and the other side is recalling events, saying what happened. Also, the left and right hemispheres have different problem-solving approaches. The right hemisphere bases its judgments on simple frequency information, while the left relies on the formation of elaborate hypotheses. So this makes me wonder, like, which side would lean dark side? Because, you know, the left is, again, partial to distorted recall, the very sort of distortion that we see in the fall of, say, Anakin Skywalker. But it also relies on, the idea of elaborate hypotheses, which, again, matches up with some of Skywalker's inner torment or as well as the expressed worldview of his master, Darth Sidious, Emperor Palpatine, right? And perhaps the light, the right side of the Force, the side of the brain here, is more about simple frequency information and accurate recall. So instead of the distorted worldview, like this is the world as it is, like a more logical approach to reality.
So if there is anything to interpreter theory, it seems to me pretty clear that it'd be the left side that's the dark side, right? Because what's the dark side do? The dark side, you tell a story in which your actions are justified because of some reason, right? Well, I had to do it because I had to save Padme.
Right, right. Where the logical side is like, no, you're just like straight up killing people.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, what would Darth Sidious say to all this? What would Palpatine say? Mm-hmm. And I think he might well argue that it's only through mental gymnastics that we arrive at the Jedi way, mm-hmm. that the Jedi exists because they're telling themselves this story over and over again. They're creating their own mythology to rationalize their tyranny, and that the dark side is just the shortest logical path. Like that Sidious is the sane man in the universe that has been deluded by this ancient religion.
Darth Sidious makes a good point. You know, I think it would work better, actually, though, if the Sith Lords were not always saying, like, yes, we are the dark side. We are mm-hmm. the bad guys. Like, what if Darth Sidious had been like, no, it's the Jedi who are the dark side?
Well, I think he also realized that, you know, dark side is good branding, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it looks cool. I mean, seriously, who looks cooler, Darth Vader or what, Yoda or Obi-Wan Kenobi? I mean,
yeah. Have you ever seen, there's an illustration, I think this is from a comic or something, where they did an alternate reality where Darth Vader fully redeemed himself and survived at some point in, like, say, Return of the Jedi. Hmm. And then he's still in his armor, but now it's white armor. So
okay.
It's like a white Darth Vader outfit. And I mean, it's kind of a neat idea. I love the idea of exploring alternate possibilities. But on the other hand, it just doesn't look as cool as it does in black.
Oh, I think he should have kept it. I mean, I don't love anyway, like the simple, like color coordinating of morality. I mean, like that's mm-hmm. dumb. I mean, and they already transcended in some ways, like the stormtroopers are dressed in clean white, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think they should let Darth Vader keep his original armor. I mean, it looks awesome. Before we move on from the split brain stuff, I just wanted to throw in, so there's some more nuance on the subject, that research I alluded to in recent years that's put some challenges to the original split brain research. I think a lot of that was associated with a researcher named Pinto, I think named Yair Pinto, who I think is a Dutch neuropsychologist. And basically what that person and colleagues have argued is that the split brain experiments actually just proved divided perception, not divided consciousness. But then people have defended the original research coming back against that. I don't remember how all of the back and forth worked out right now, but just be aware that there is ongoing division about that. In fact, split brain researchers appear to be somewhat divided, we may say.
Yeah. Well, I'm of two minds myself on it.
Yeah.
Right. Speaking of which, back to the Syrian binary brain. Again, they're apparently noted for their ability to come at a topic from both sides simultaneously. And I got to thinking about that. I mean, on one hand, I was wondering, again, is this something they do naturally or is it only accessible via training? But I suppose one way to really tackle the problem is, again, to come back to human cognition and to ask what seems like it should be a pretty simple question. Is it possible for a human to think two things at one time, not to juggle between thoughts or to focus on like a combination of two things? Like, mm-hmm. you know, for instance, I can think about a human and I can think about a horse. You know, I can sort of go back and forth between the two. I can focus on the idea of a centaur and kind of involve, you know, both of them at once. But can I think about a horse and a human on, and actually do parallel lines of thought at the same time?
So not this is a mixture between a horse and a human, but to think simultaneously, this is 100% horse and this is 100% human at the same time.
Right. Can I, what's the business lingo? Dual track?
Parallel path.
Parallel path, yeah.
I think that means something somewhat different. But yeah, I know what you're saying. Being able to, I mean, I think it's a really important thing in good mental hygiene and training your brain to work well, that you are able to hold conflicting ideas in your mind in order to figure out which one makes more sense. I mean, I think it's our natural tendency to kind of to instead get a feel for conflicting ideas pretty quickly, figure out which one we're more attached to, and then just fully commit to that one and not consider the other at all. But I think also maybe you're getting at something different, which is not being able to consider conflicting ideas or conflicting explanations for something. You're talking more about like having the focus of attention in the mind be two different things at the same time. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Yeah. That's a different thing. And that's also very interesting because this once again gets into like, what is consciousness? And one of the central features of consciousness seems to be this spotlight quality to it, right? That consciousness seems to have a basically like one focal point of attention at a time, and other things can kind of intrude on consciousness suddenly. But if you are thinking about a horse, you're also not simultaneously thinking with the same level of focus and intensity about a person.
Right. And so this is something that a psychologist by the name of Nick, I believe it is Chater. I could have his last name pronounced wrong. If so, I apologize here. It's C-H-A-T-E-R. But he is the author of The Mind is Flat, The Illusion of Mental Depth in the Improvised Mind. And what he would argue here is that we depend on a cycle of thought whereby a number of systems work to push forward ideas step by step. He would argue, I think, if he were to weigh in on this topic, that our limited human neural capacity is only sufficient to pursue one goal at a time. And maybe, just maybe, doubled human neural capacity is what it would actually take to truly dual track something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. So he's saying to consider, it's kind of how when we're making like a to-do list, you have to break tasks apart into like individual steps and do them mm-hmm. one at a time. I find, you know, doing that for me, it definitely helps me organize the flow of work a lot better. But maybe if you had a more powerful mind, if you had like two brains in your head, you could actually you wouldn't have to break things into parts quite so much. You could, you know, consider more sort of umbrella tasks with all of their subdivided parts simultaneously.
Yeah, and I think ultimately it's very difficult to imagine what that would be like. I mean, it's kind of like trying to imagine, well, what would our view of reality be like if we could also, feel the magnetosphere or something, you know, or mm-hmm. or see wavelengths of light that we don't have access to, that sort of thing. The author of The Mind is Flat, he was also a co-author on a paper along with Elizabeth A. Mailer and Gregory V. Jones from 2001 titled Searching for Two Things at Once. And in this, the authors conducted an experiment into whether retrieval from semantic memory and autobiographical memory is exclusive or whether people can search for two things at once. And they concluded that, quote, exclusivity was observed to occur in retrieval among multiple non-overlapping categories in both semantic and autobiographical memory. Again, they're talking about about memory recall here, but this also seems to get at sort of the same idea. I was reading a summary of The Mind is Flat by Stephen Poole for The Guardian, and they summarize some of this by saying, quote, "We can't even see two or more colors at once, but switch between one at a time. In general, our richness of experience seems to be a construct." And we've touched on some of this before as well, especially with vision, about like how you know, we have this idea in our mind that the whole everything we can see with our eyes at one time are in like full color and maybe even full detail. But you don't have to really get too experimental. You can just to realize that this is not the case.
Yeah, and there are tons of examples of this. If you close one eye, you still feel like you have total vision and you can see all around. But in fact, there's a blind spot caused by your optic nerve and you just don't see that there is a blind spot there. Mm-hmm. Or one of the other examples we've often cited is color blindness and peripheral vision. You believe that you can see color in your peripheral vision until you try it. Like somebody holds up different colored objects right at the edge of where you can see, and it turns out you can't see different colors there. You can only see vague things. Something is moving, even though it totally, 100%, it feels like I can see color in my periphery. Yeah.
So very roughly, if we take that idea and we extrapolate it to cognition itself, we see the limitations of our focus. We see the limitations of how we construct a world and focus on it. You could basically break it down to the idea of we have the one spotlight. But if we had two brains in our head, would we essentially have two spotlights?
That's very interesting, and it makes me wonder what the practical differences in, a culture and a technosphere and a science developed by people with brains of that type would be like.
Yeah.
How is art different if you can focus on more than one thing at a time? How is science and technology different if you can focus on more than one thing at a time?
Yeah, or even your use of symbols and language, etc. I mean, coming back to the idea of the centaur. The centaur exists to a certain extent because it combines two things into one and drags in aspects of both of those independent things. But would these forms be necessary for the Saurians, or would they by necessity, would all of their hybrids be more complex chimeras that involve multiple aspects, at least four aspects? Because in terms of just contemplating two parallels, they can do that on their own. They don't need a symbol to help with it.
Hmm. This is really interesting. I want more about the Saurians now. I want Saurian focused Star Wars stories.
I want a Master Mundi novelization to read. Why do we not have one? Mace Windu got his own book.
It's really, really difficult to follow his inner monologue, though.
Oh, man. It's actually two volumes, and you have to read them at the same time. That's why it's never been.
Oh, wait. No, that's a fantastic idea, actually. You write two different novels that narrate the exact same events, but one is from each brain in the head. That's that could be good.
Now that would actually be a fun short story exercise if someone wanted to keep it simple. All right, talk about his death, the final moments leading up to his death, to his betrayal by the clone troopers he was working aside. What is one account of it and what is the other? I guess one account is kind of I didn't see this coming at all. The other account is that makes sense.
I guess I should have talked to the other brain about this before we ran out
on the bridge.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I say we close out on the Saurians for now. Obviously, there are a ton of other weird brains and multi-headed things we could talk about in Star Wars universe. But for some reason, I think the Saurian was the one that captured my imagination the most here.
This was a very good pick.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, what do you have, Joe? What do you have for us?
Okay, well, you had to help me with the Star Wars aspect of this one, because I admit this is one that I backed into because I got interested in the analogy animal from reality first. To be fully transparent, this is a type of animal that I first started looking at for our episode last week, I think it was, about the sargassum seaweed. But then I realized that it didn't really fit super well into that episode. This animal is not especially associated with sargassum, only in certain occasions. So I figured I would actually save it for this, and I found what I believe is a fantastic wedge to get it into the Star Wars universe. But I felt like I had to hold up a hand and be honest about where this comes from.
Oh, fair enough.
But I wanted to think about bipedal aquatic humanoid aliens, sentient water creatures who stand up on 2 feet with a Homo sapiens posture. Now, the first one I thought about is not your excellent pick here. It's something that doesn't quite fit my animal as well. But the first one I wanted to talk about is one of my favorites from childhood, Admiral Akbar from Return of the Jedi. And I think he's been featured in many other things since. But Admiral Akbar, the noble, brilliant, big-eyed commander of the Rebel fleet during its attack on the second Death Star. Famously, he discovers it is a trap.
Yeah, he's a super fun character. Wonderful, just wonderful special effects makeup mm-hmm. to create that guy. And that species is fleshed out a bit more in the Clone Wars animated series as well. We get to go to their home world of Mon Cala, mm-hmm. which is this ocean world. And it's also where the Quarren live. I don't know if you remember these guys. They were also, I think, first shown to us in Return of the Jedi, but they're like a squid face guy.
Yes.
Yeah, they pop up in Jabba's palace, I believe.
Yeah, so Admiral Akbar's species is called the Mon Calamari, and they are native to this home planet of Mon Cala. But also, yes, the Quarrens, these other creatures who look more like... So the Mon Calamari are an amphibious species, and they look sort of... I guess the closest analogy in Earth life would be they look kind of like frogs. They've got frog-like eyes and kind of frog-like skin, and it would make sense since they're supposed to be amphibious. But the Quarrens, they look more like bipedal humans, basically, but with squids for heads.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've sometimes been called like kind of Cthulhu aliens.
Yeah.
Now, the Mon Calamari, this does raise a number of questions itself, because I wonder, how does the bipedalism of the Mon Calamari evolve? Like, bipedalism and limited bipedal behaviors can be found in a number of terrestrial animals on Earth. You've got birds and their extinct theropod dinosaur relatives, some reptiles such as, the reptiles we've discussed in the past, lizards that run on the water with two back legs, of course, in primates. So a number of animals will stand up on two legs. But almost all the cases I can think of with this involve animals that are standing on or walking on solid land, or walking or running across the top of the water. And it's actually still a matter of debate in a pretty interesting way how human ancestors developed full-time bipedalism. One of the bygone hypotheses you've probably heard, this was from the old days, was that human ancestors evolved bipedalism so that they could see over the tall grasses of the savanna. But I think this hypothesis is mostly discarded now. One of the main reasons is that it looks like from the fossil record that humans became bipedal when they still lived primarily in an arboreal environment, so around the trees, not in grasslands with tall grasses. And so there are a number of competing hypotheses today, one of which that's pretty interesting, or I guess several actually, get into the idea that bipedalism evolved because of the evolutionary advantages in various different ways of having free hands available for carrying things around while you move.
Yeah, as I'm hunting and gathering, like I need those free hands to hold like my satchel of collected berries or mushrooms, or the tools that I'm using.
Yeah, to like bring back to your family from across a long distance or something like that. But there could be another explanation that's better. This is one of those things where I think it's wide open. You know, there are tons of different ideas competing. And so it's very interesting for that reason. But whatever the reason that human ancestors evolved full-time bipedalism, it does seem kind of weird to imagine bipedalism evolving in an aquatic or mostly aquatic species. Like, what are they walking around on? You know, are they walking around on the ocean floor? In order to do that, it would seem like they would have to be very dense, right? Like they sink to the bottom and they need to stand up and walk around on the bottom. You'd imagine they'd mostly be geared for swimming. Though maybe, I don't know, because the Mon Calamari, it says that they're an amphibious species. Maybe they evolved bipedalism for whatever part of their life they spend walking around outside the water on the land, if they do that at all. I don't know all that much about the Mon Calamari, but amphibious, maybe.
Yeah, in the episodes of Clone Wars where they're more fleshed out, we don't really, all we see are, I think, some like big submersible environments and, of course, a lot of like open water warfare that's taking place. So I don't know if ultimately we get much in the way of answers from that show either.
But in thinking about other bipedal upright water aliens in the Star Wars universe, Rob, you're going to have to help me with this one because you connected me to this species and I knew nothing about it previously. But there is a species from the Star Wars universe called the Nephran, N-E-P-H-R-A-N. And this is much closer to what I want to talk about here, because this is a bipedal aquatic alien that's more like a crustacean, like a bipedal shrimp or crab. They are said to come from an ocean world in the Star Wars galaxy called Nepotis, and the main example character of this species is a person from stuff I haven't seen called Therm Scissorpunch. Rob, can you fill me in? You know about Therm?
Yeah, so this is a character, if memory serves, pops up in the movie Solo, which is, of course, the Han Solo prequel, which I know some folks didn't care for. We thought it was a lot of fun when we watched it as a family. It certainly has some great aliens in it, for sure. And this is one of them. This kind of shrimpy, squiddy-looking guy. And he's wearing what looks to be like an interstellar flight suit. So this seems to support like the theory that underwater creatures in the Star Wars universe perhaps have an advantage when it comes to navigating the three-dimensional world of open space. Because again, think of the Mon Calamari. Where do we encounter them time and time again?
Strategic commanders.
Commanders during space warfare. So it makes you wonder, would they have some sort of advantage? They're used to the oceanic environment, like the open water warfare environment and the survival environment. Are they better than contemplating threats in outer space?
That would make a lot of sense. Now, there are still some important differences. I'd say one of the most important differences is even within the water column, you've still got an up and down. You've got gravity and buoyancy, which you don't have in space. In space, there's no up and down. It's just a limitless three-dimensional space. But even with that, you can still see the advantage where you're naturally evolutionarily adapted to combat within a space where you can move in three different dimensions in a way that we can't really on the surface of the Earth. Like, you can jump and you can climb a tree and stuff, but mostly you're just going to be on flat ground when you're fighting other people.
Yeah.
And of course you can have aircraft and stuff, but that's not really part of the ancestral environment that, that shaped our brains.
Yeah, I imagine the reverse though is probably true too. If a crustacean alien had an advantage in imagining open space warfare, they'd probably also be really disadvantaged imagining like a land warfare.
Yeah,
they would be like what's your command, general? And they would be like, move
swim
sideways,
away. Yeah.
Swim away, yeah, get back in the water,
I can't.
Crawl under a rock.
So this guy's called Therm Scissor Punch, and at first the name seemed weird to me until I connected it to the fact that he has crab-like claws instead of hands. So if he punches you, I guess it is much like being punched with a giant, blunt pair of scissors.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, but here we're going to make the lateral leap to real biology, because I've got a crustacean with an eerily human bipedal-type posture to talk about, and this is the skeleton shrimp. From the crustacean family Caprellidae, this is one absolutely to look up pictures of. Go Google skeleton shrimp while I'm talking about this. They look very cool, very creepy. And on top of that, and on top of their kind of haunting, creepy appearance, they somehow to me look a little bit obscene. I can't quite explain it very well, but they look like an acolyte of some horrible shadow god that was rightly banished to the Cavern of Tears.
Yeah, they are very strange looking. And that's even if you're approaching it with the idea that, yeah, there are a lot of different shrimp in the ocean and not all shrimp, you know, look like the shrimp that you might buy at the seafood store. But these guys especially, I feel like they earn their nickname, the skeleton shrimp or the ghost shrimp. They look like some sort of a horrible shrimpy wraith.
Wraith shrimp, that would be a good name for them. I think they're called skeleton shrimp because they typically have a very spindly appearance. They're almost like a stick insect, but creepier.
Yeah.
Now, they're typically very small. They range in size from a few millimeters to a couple of inches long. But if you get up close and you look at them with some magnification, you'll notice that they often have an upright posture where they will stretch their body out as they cling on to something with their back legs. So in that sense, they look eerily human. But in addition to this, they often have a kind of bent over supplicant posture within that upstanding position, almost looking like they're in prayer, again, I guess, to that rightly banished god.
Yeah. In a way, similar posture to old Scissor Punch there. He looks a little bit bent over in the stills I have of him.
Oh, yes, you're right. In some of the stills I've seen of him, he looks like he's hanging his head or maybe like he's about to bow down at the altar.
Gravity is really hard on him, but he must gamble. He must play cards.
So I was wondering if my raw sense of obscenity when looking at a skeleton shrimp comes from the different body parts that seem to defy type. It has antennae that look like legs and claws that look like heads and little claws near the face of the actual head. Its main claws are called nathopods, and it has smaller nathopods near its face that look kind of like hip facial hair, or I don't know how hip it would be, the kind of facial hair that makes a statement. Now, despite being called skeleton shrimp, these are not exactly super closely related to the shrimp that you would eat in your shrimp cocktail. Skeleton shrimp, in fact, consistent with what I was just saying about their different weird claws and legs, they are of an order of crustaceans known as amphipods, which literally means different feet, as opposed to related crustaceans that have more consistent sets of feet. And I was reading about them on a page for the Monterey Bay Aquarium that mentions that these animals are sometimes called praying mantises of the sea. I can absolutely understand the comparison, in addition to the, of course, praying posture I mentioned. The claws look very much like the raptorial forelegs of a praying mantis. So skeleton shrimp are often camouflaged within their environment, making forests of seaweed a really great habitat for them. They're often found clinging to bryozoans, hydroids, or eelgrass, sometimes even in patches of sargassum, which we talked about last week, though skeleton shrimp are found in other habitats as well. You can find them on a ship's hull or on some other animal's body even. One video I was watching of skeleton shrimp showed hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands of tiny skeleton shrimp clinging to the scales of a scorpion fish.
Oh, and they were
crowded right around the fish's eye. I tried to take a screen grab so you could see it here, Rob, down below. But they're just crowded around the eye and all over the top of his head, and they're just swaying around in the water. And the fish does not really look put out.
I know. Like, at first glance, these look like eyebrows and tufts of hair. Yeah. Almost kind of zat-ish tufts of hair, you know?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes they can look quite fuzzy, especially when the females are carrying their brood along with them. After mating, they reproduce sexually. And after mating, the females will sometimes carry around what looks almost like a ball of dandelion fuzz or something. But that's all their young that haven't left the mother's body yet. Now, the different appendages jutting off of their bodies provide a range of different ways to survive. In general, their back legs are for gripping onto a substrate, and this is where you get the bipedal posture here. You will very often see skeleton shrimp clinging to something, a piece of seaweed or even a scorpion fish's head or something, with their back legs while their body is stretched out above that, looking like they're standing up and reaching out into the water. And then meanwhile, while they're clinging with their back legs and standing up like this, their larger front legs with the folding features that look like mantis claws, these can be used for grooming the body or for violence in fighting each other, which it seems like they do a lot, or for snagging food. And the antennae coming off of their head apparently can sometimes be used for filter feeding. They eat everything, it seems. Different species of them will eat different things sometimes, but they're pretty omnivorous. They scavenge for floating detritus, meaning particles of dead organic matter that are just sort of like hanging around in the water. Sometimes they eat algae, or sometimes they act as predators. They can snag, kill, and eat live prey, for example, worms or crustacean larvae. And though they look very bipedal when they're attached to a substrate and reaching out into the water, I thought this was interesting. They generally move not by walking on their back legs, but by gripping the substrate, folding their body over, and then sliding along like an inchworm. Again, very creepy. And there's another fascinating comparison to the praying mantis. Some species of skeleton shrimp practice sexual homicide, where the female will kill the male after mating, sometimes by stabbing them with a special claw and injecting them with venom, which strikes me as a very interesting example of convergent evolution, because, of course, there's this superficial resemblance between the body form of a praying mantis and a skeleton shrimp. They have these similar raptorial forelegs and similar posture and stuff. And like a praying mantis, sometimes the female will kill the male after mating, though I didn't see much about the female eating the male after mating. Maybe they do, because sometimes these skeleton shrimp are cannibalistic, but mainly I just saw about killing the male with this venomous claw. I was wondering why it would be that the female would kill the male after mating. I wonder if this is in part to prevent the males from cannibalizing them or their offspring in the future. So there are a couple of things there, one of which is that mating, so of course these crustaceans, like other crustaceans, they have to grow by molting, right? Because having a hard outer exoskeleton, you can't get bigger with a hardened outer exoskeleton. You have to shed the exoskeleton and then come out as a larger, soft version of yourself, and then the outer layer of you hardens into a new, larger exoskeleton. This is the molting process, and apparently skeleton shrimp can only mate when the female is freshly molted. So, I don't know, possibly that means that she could be in a more vulnerable position around the time of mating, or it could be to prevent males from eating the new larva that will be coming along soon. I don't know, I wonder.
I like the idea that they may have a special claw for this, though.
Oh, yeah, with the venom in it. Apparently, the males also sometimes have venomous claws, which they use for fighting each other. I think in some cases, at least for access to mating.
Real scissor punches there.
Right, exactly. But as I said already, skeleton shrimp are really something that you need to see with your eyes to appreciate. So I would highly recommend looking up some pictures and looking up some videos of these animals. They're very small, but they're beautiful, creepy, unsettling, worth your attention.
Absolutely.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
All right, I think we have time for one more specimen here.
Oh, boy.
And for this one, Joe, I'm going to have to ask you to come to the planet Naboo with me.
Well, I'll always go to Naboo.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting world. I would say one of the most interesting in the Star Wars universe, because even outside of its important role in galactic history, it has just incredibly rich fauna. You have human settlers coming to the planet at some point, and then there's signs of an elder civilization. But you have this native Gungan population that are an advanced amphibious species that make their home in underwater cities in the planet's expansive underwater oceans. Naboo seems to have a vast number of impressive land animals, many of which are used as battle mounts by the Gungans. But then you have this shadowy underwater realm that is home to just many, many marine organisms. And there's a fabulous section in The Phantom Menace where we get to explore it a bit. It's the scene where we have our main characters there with the kid, I think, and Jar Jar, and they're in a submarine, and they are attacked by one giant underwater creature after another, each one bigger and more horrifying than the last.
Out of the frying pan and into the fish.
Yes. So the first one that attacks is this thing that's an OPC killer that looks kind of like a deep sea anglerfish type of a thing. Then they're attacked by the Kolo clawfish, which looks like a cross between a crocodile and an eel. And then finally, by this even more titanic Sando aqua monster, which is just an apex of apex predators, looks like some sort of a salamandery giant.
Do I recall that in this sequence, they are trying to like take a submarine through the center of the world to get to the other side of the planet or something?
I don't remember if they're actually going through the center, but they are at the very least, yeah, they're going through the deep underwater sections of the world to get to a specific location.
Okay. Maybe it might just be underwater caves.
Yeah, but I don't know. It could be if it's the former, then it's Dante-esque in its nature, right?
Oh yeah.
But anyway, the creature of these three I want to talk about is that middle one, the Kolo clawfish, which is pretty neat looking. I mean, all three of these are impressive creatures. This one is again enormous. Its head is larger than the Gungan sub. We're told in like the Alien Archive and other books that they can reach lengths of at least 40 meters or 131 feet. They're long bioluminescent predators with mandible-like forelegs to grip their prey, and this long mouth of razor-sharp teeth. And I believe they're supposed to have venomous fangs in there as well to partially or completely disable some of their prey. And they can unhinge their jaw like a terrestrial snake in order to eat prey larger than their own head. But the part that interests me the most here is this one little tidbit that is described in the Star Wars Alien Archive book. Quote, however, Kolos must ensure their prey is dead before ingesting it. Their digestive systems are slow, and they run the risk of being eaten from inside out if the prey remains alive.
Whoa.
So, obviously, that got me thinking. I was like, is there anything like this here on Earth? And I found an excellent article on this in BBC Earth by Sandrine Kirstamont. This is from 2017, and they made some wonderful points on this. So basically, as the author points out, you'd probably need two key realities to be in place for something like this to happen. So first of all, the animal would have to survive the jaws of its attacker. It would have to be swallowed whole. No fatal crushing, no incapacitating venom, inserted into the creature. It would
no death roll or death shake.
Yeah, no death roll, no death shake, no intentional breaking of the bones like you see with like a cattle do to its rodent prey.
Yeah.
It would just have to happen in the case of an animal that just gulps its prey down whole. Secondly, the digestive juices would have to be weak enough and or the prey's outer covering would have to be resilient enough for it to survive entry into the stomach, at least initial entry, if not its entire time there.
Yeah, so it seems like maybe there's some risk at like swallowing whole a creature with a hard outer layer. Like if you swallowed a whole crab, that could be pretty bad.
Right. And then also it would help if the prey in question has some sort of ace up its sleeve as well. So as the author explains, yes, there are cases where all of these things seem to line up. The first one is the rough-skinned newt can survive being swallowed by a frog. And in large part, this is because it packs enough toxin to kill the predator before the digestive juices overpower it. Quote, then the newt simply has to crawl back up the dead frog's throat and out of its mouth, which is pretty badass. I like that.
Yes, that is power you can respect.
Now, the next example is even weirder and maybe not as cool in the sense that like it's not a full survival story, but it's still really amazing. Mm-hmm. And that is the case of the Brahmini blind snake, a tiny natural burrower, and it has been observed to survive the digestion of a toad and emerge out the other end of the toad, essentially swallowed by the toad and then just wriggles through the rest of the way and out the rear entry or the rear exit, as it were. So in these cases of survival, it also really helps if it maybe even be essential that there's not another big meal up ahead of it blocking the way.
Ah, I see.
But then this is also a situation where protection from the digestive juices seems to be key. This is what the author, Kirstemann, had to say. Quote, "But its skin was probably the biggest lifesaver. The closely knit, overlapping scales that help blind snakes move on land would likely block gastric juices, preventing them from reaching delicate tissues and organs. The scales of other snakes come apart slightly when they move, so would not have the same protective effect."
Well, it's like a natural hazmat suit.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever considered this as a strategy for defending against predators before. When I've always thought about trying to avoid getting eaten, I've thought about trying to escape or trying to fight back, not preventing eating from hurting you.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, just get eaten and, you know, you'll be okay, probably.
Now, it may be a case, first of all, it seems to be a case where this is not, certainly not an evolved way of surviving predators. And it also seems to be a case where survival is perhaps an incorrect term for it, because this, in the case that it was observed by researchers here, the snake died 5 hours later, probably due to complications due to lack of oxygen. Because that's the thing, even if you're armored against that that acid, or the acid isn't strong enough, mm-hmm. you're still going to be inside that animal for a certain amount of time if you're not killing it with toxins and climbing out the front. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to take the complete journey through, you're going to be without oxygen. And depending on your biology, you know, that can have very detrimental effects. That itself can be the fatal flaw.
Okay, so you're saying this is not, it doesn't appear that these tiny snakes have evolved a capacity to be eaten and survive specifically as a protection against predation. It just so happens, like it's a coincidence, that some of their natural defenses for other things happen to allow them to survive passing through the digestive system in at least this case or limited cases.
Yeah. And maybe it's more of a curse, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, maybe.
They get to survive the whole process.
Yeah.
Now, on top of these cases, apparently there are some land snails that can survive the journey through a bird's digestive system. And this is a case where you have another important helpful fact here, and that is speedier digestion time. So just less time spent in the bird's digestive system. That means less exposure to the digestive juices, coupled with the natural protection of the snail shell, which is key, but also the mucus of the snail might also help serve as a protective barrier.
Oh, like a chemical armor.
Yeah. And so you have some aquatic snails as well that have been observed to be very resilient to digestion. You have nematode worms, of course, some of which are true internal parasites. So yeah, once you get into that territory, I think we're more inclined to, if not expect, but you know, not be surprised by that kind of resiliency. Things that survive in the digestive system of host organisms. But you generally don't think about snakes, salamanders, and other things, having a chance once they're actually in the predator's gullet.
Rob, you have opened my eyes.
So to come back to the planet Naboo, I guess the idea here is that we're largely talking about other deadly predators in the depths of Naboo that, after having been eaten, then turn on the predator host here. It's just that crazy an environment. So it seems entirely feasible that you could have something like this. Like maybe there's one particular type of fish or creature in that deep sea underground environment of Naboo, and if it eats those, it gets too excited about them. Maybe its venom doesn't work on that particular creature, or sometimes maybe it doesn't use its venom. Often we see that with snakes, right? They're not going to use their venom every time if they don't have to. It is an important resource, but maybe that's a fatal mistake for the colo concerning certain prey species.
You don't want to underestimate what you're eating.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all I have, Joe.
Should we close the compendium?
Let's close it up. Now, obviously, there are tons of other creatures and aliens in the Star Wars universe. So, you know, perhaps there are some other really good candidates that we didn't touch on. If you have suggestions for the future, let us know. Likewise, you know, we could always take this approach to other, fictional ecosystems and take a look at those. I know we had some fun talking about the sandworms of Dune several years back.
Dune is coming back.
Yeah, yeah. I need to revisit. I think I have some ideas jotted down about things we might consider when we get a little closer to Dune time.
Well, that's exciting.
And hey, there are probably other worlds I'm not even thinking of. I mean, I guess there's Star Trek too. I don't think we've ever done anything on Star Trek. If we have, I'm certainly not remembering it.
Did you actually watch Star Trek? You weren't really a Star Trek guy, were you?
I wasn't an original Star Trek guy, but there was. I watched tons of Next Generation and tons of Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
And you know, some of the movies, but that was my area. Like, I think it was like every evening at 9 p.m. Next Generation was on, and I always watched it. Like, that was my go-to for a while.
I like in the I haven't seen all of the Next Generation, but I like those episodes. I think especially in the early seasons of TNG, where they would go down to a planet and it would just look like a 1990s family portrait photo studio with some potted plants on it.
yeah, I remember some of those settings.
I think I've said this on the show before, but I don't know exactly why. I always really, really love a good cheap indoor for outdoor set.
I've also really been thinking about this a lot in terms of the 1990s Outer Limits series, mm-hmm. where they have some great sets on that show, but also each episode is like, okay, what are they about to film in like the Toronto area that they're going to make look like the future or the post-apocalyptic world? Like, there's some interesting choices at times where it's like, it's not really an impressive building they're working with here, but they try and figure out ways to shoot it in such a way that it feels fresh and different compared to all these other episodes they're pumping out.
So they're actually writing around the secondhand sets and costumes and stuff?
They seem to, and I haven't seen all the Outer Limits yet, but they seem to do a pretty good job of not repeating themselves, which I think can be hard when you have so many episodes that are about being trapped in an alien spaceship, being trapped in a survival bunker. You know, like a lot of the same basic setups are going to be in place. Like, I wonder how many different alien hallways they create, alien spaceship hallways they created for this show, and still found a way to make them feel different enough, if not, you know, substantially different.
It's the mark of a good bottle episode. Different enough.
Yep, just different enough.
All right, should we wrap up?
Let's wrap up. If you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts, and wherever that happens to be, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.